Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting up-and-coming new director Reinaldo Marcus Green to talk about his hard-hitting debut feature film, Monsters and Men.
Then we'll be hearing from musical legend and former Bad Seed, Mick Harvey.
And we'll be reflecting on the incredible changes New York has seen in the last four decades with artist Jane Dixon.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Paige Reynolds will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are again, Aug, in the cosy confines of Studio One at Midori House. A great pleasure, as ever, to see you on my precious Sunday lunchtime for a bit of Monocle Weekly action.
It's lovely, isn't it? It's the first Sunday we've spent together in 2019.
But you're well rested after your Christmas break. Not too far flung, unlike many at Monocle. Not to distant shores over Christmas and New Year. Just up to old Canterbridgia.
Sadly, Cambridge bound. I enjoyed a few nice outings along the backs.
Right, well, what else has been happening this week? Always busy, especially the sort of first proper week back with everyone from all points, north, south, east and west, joining us back here at Midori House. It's been busy, hasn't it? Hive of activity as ever.
Frenetic.
And what about anything jumped out at you from around the world? Interesting things going on?
Well, I was happy to see Olivia Colman getting recognised for her role in The Favourite at the Golden Globes.
Have you seen the piece?
Well, interestingly enough, I've tried to four times, but each time I go, I just decide to do something else instead.
Oh, I thought you were going to be thwarted by some
malevolent
force.
I simply changed my mind once I went home and watched John Malkovich playing Hercule Poirot, which I thought was inspired bit of casting. Another time I went to the Public House. Lots of other things to do, but I will see it.
Was that a morning screening that fell by the wayside that day?
Indeed, yeah, last Saturday.
Well, let's find out not just what's been going on over the last few days, but what could potentially lie ahead in the next 7 days. It's time to gaze into the crystal ball that is the week ahead.
Everybody's talking front page news.
And here to make sense of what could be a torrid few days ahead is Monocle's own Paige Reynolds. Good afternoon, Paige. Nice to see you in your Sunday finery. What's caught your eye for the forthcoming 7 days?
Well, there is quite a bit going on. I think the big story of the week will be the meaningful vote happening in the UK Parliament on Brexit. So last week we saw sort of 5 days of really heated debates, and one of the outcomes was a quite controversial decision by the Speaker of the House, John Bercow, who by the end of Wednesday had enabled MPs to vote for an amendment that if May's deal is defeated on Tuesday, she'll need to present a Plan B in at most 3 days. So that's, I think, thrown a spanner in the works for sort of whatever happens on Tuesday. And so this vote was delayed from the December 11th vote that was meant to happen, so May could sort of go around Europe and try and sort of cajole some support. Unfortunately, a defeat is looking likely. So we'll see, I guess.
Well, I was going to ask you, it's interesting it's being termed a meaningful vote. It's the meaning could be lacking, couldn't it? Depending. I mean, it may mean nothing if it's defeated and we get no closer.
No, I think it definitely could mean nothing, but I think the sort of what next will become a little bit clearer. So there are going to be some outcomes. So perhaps Labour might propose a vote of no confidence to force a general election. We might see Parliament pushing for a second referendum, and we might just get a little bit closer to that much dreaded no deal. So,
or we could just see a delay to that March 29th deadline.
Yeah.
That's surely the most likely outcome at this point. However, we're probably hostage fortune talking any further. So let's move on. What else has caught your eye?
So fashion season has well and truly kicked off. So Monocle's fashion editor, Jamie Waters, has begun his grand European tour. Last week, he was in Pitti Uomo in Florence. He's now in Milan for Men's Fashion Week there. And this week, we'll have the start of the big major event, which is Paris Men's Fashion Week. So it's going to be held from Tuesday the 15th through to Sunday. And we've got all the big names there. So it starts out with a show from Heron Preston, who's the sort of cultural icon of the streetwear scene. And it closes with a sort of a more classical menswear brand, Celine. And there are a few things to watch out for. So we've got Fumitu Ganryu's follow-up collection since his return to the industry. So he used to be previously with Comme des Garçons, and he showcased his eponymous label for the first time last summer at Pitti. And he's quite arty. He's got the central theme of water sort of running through his first collection. It was quite conceptual, so it'll be interesting to see what his sort of second offerings will look like. We've also got Chris Van Asch's first Abelou runway after leaving Dior Homme, and Kim Jones's latest for Dior Homme. Looking at the the echoes of that sort of menswear switch up that we saw last year will be quite interesting to see.
Interesting to see how it pans out. I've been reading a lot recently about the kind of gradually declining fortunes of streetwear, which obviously has become a cornerstone of, you know, both label and high street fashion. Be fascinated to see what comes back from this. Where next?
Finally, I thought we'd have a look at, you know, as well as sort of the fashion season kicking off, we've also got the awards season in the film industry kicking off. So we've had the Golden Globes, the BAFTA nominations were also announced last week. But a film that's being released in the UK this week, perhaps to slightly less fanfare than his previous work, is Barry Jenkins's If Beale Street Could Talk, which is being released in the UK on Friday. So many will know Jenkins as the director of Moonlight, which after a slight fiasco, was awarded Best Picture at the Oscars in 2017. And If Beale Street Could Talk is the first actual English language adaptation of James Baldwin's work. And I think we actually did, in a later season of The Big Interview, our very own Ben Rylan interviewed Barry Jenkins about his life, about his work. And I think he was extremely excited to take on such an icon such as James Baldwin and sort of put that onto the screen. So I'll be intrigued to see how that pans out.
If people want to hear that Barry Jenkins interview with Ben, episode 93 of The Big Interview, broadcast on the 2nd of December 2018. Fascinating stuff, Paige. Plenty of those stories which you can hear a great deal more about by staying tuned to Monocle 24 in the next 7 days. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, and stick around, more feature film chat coming up. Ronaldo Marcus Green and his debut feature Monsters and Men after this. Ronaldo Marcus Green has attracted widespread acclaim for his debut feature, Monsters and Men. The director's path to the silver screen has been more circumspect than his success might suggest. Before pursuing directing, he had a career both on Wall Street and as an educator.
Monsters and Men presents an unflinching look at the fallout from the police shooting of an unarmed black man in New York. The narrative follows three characters, each struggling to make sense of the killing. It's a powerful drama, dealing with weighty themes, but that's not to say it isn't also entertaining. I caught up with Ronaldo to learn more about the film and his path to the director's chair. But first, here's a clip.
Is there nothing better to do on a Monday night?
Sir, just step back, please.
Back.
All right, sir. Just step back, please.
I live right there. All right. I'm not walking home anyway.
Get the cops. Get the cops. Get
the cops.
So what do the police want with you?
Yeah, they want me to keep quiet.
I saw the tape.
So what, you're gonna go blab about it? They're gonna make an example out of you.
What should I do?
Just got a new job. I'm about to graduate. Everything's gonna change if you just put this out there.
Well, what would you do? What would you do if somebody twice your size is coming at you?
He was surrounded by 6 or 8 cops.
Take seconds, Lisa.
He's dead.
You have a background as an educator. And I just wondered how that kind of communication has fed in to your current occupation of directing films.
Oh, well, yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people become teachers after they try a different career path. And, you know, teaching was something that I thought, was what I wanted to do in college. And so I actually had trained, you know, as a teacher. I got my master's in education and started running a gifted and talented program, kindergarten through fifth grade. And I think, you know, obviously, you know, there's one thing to inspire and to teach kids and to just be prepared. So every day you have, you know, you have your lesson plans, you have to get the week ready, you have to get the year ready. And I think teachers are some of the most undervalued people, but they're also the most prepared people on earth because they have the responsibility of bringing up a new generation. So I think all of that preparation, I think I didn't know I was going to apply it to film at some point, but in preparing for the students, but also preparing for the faculty and the staff. And there's so much prep that goes into what looks so simple. You know, you just get up there and you teach, you know, 2 plus 2, but there's a lot of thought and care that goes into that. And there's also a finite number of resources that most teachers, especially inner city teachers in New York City, have. And so you have to get creative and all of that prep. I didn't know that I was going to necessarily apply that to film, but being in front of the classroom, being able to sort of, you know, you got all these kids with attention spans, very short attention spans, and you have to try to entertain them, you know, entertain them and also give them the right information. And so all of that, you know, obviously is very applicable to film. At the time, again, I was not aware that I was going to go out and do something else. But in learning the skill set of doing that, I think it was obviously very easy to apply some of the things that I was successful at, given my time as an educator. So I think when I made the transition, there were a lot of things that sort of came natural in terms of being able to communicate with a crew, being able to sort of inspire people and obviously, you know, and get the job done.
I wanted to ask a bit about the way that you approach this as your first feature. You know, how does it compare to making shorts, which is what you'd worked on previously?
I didn't want it to feel like a first-time feature. And even, although I wanted it to be respected as a first-time feature, I wanted people to say, oh, wow, that was a first-time, you know, that was a first-time film. But I didn't want people coming into it and say, oh, this is great for a first-time feature. And so, you know, that as a baseline helped me raise sort of the bar a little bit. You know, it was slightly ambitious for a first film. We didn't have a ton of money, but we wanted it to sort of feel graceful. You know, a lot of the things, my short work was mostly handheld, mostly no lights. It was because we couldn't afford them. I like that aesthetic, but I think I like it because it was something that I got used to in film school based off of the toys that we had available to us. And so I think, you know, when you watch some of my favorite films, it didn't have that jerky motion. It, you know, it was a still camera. It was elegant. And I wanted Monsters and Men to sort of feel that way. I didn't want it to feel completely indie in that sense. I wanted it to have some scale. I wanted somebody like my mother, who only watches, you know, blockbuster type movies, to go and say, oh, you know, it's funny. She watched one of my short films and she felt sorry for me. She was like, oh, bendito, you know, you didn't have enough money for the lights. Like, I couldn't see anything in your short film. And, you know, it was kind of interesting. She thought it was a doc. And, you know, again, I was proud of that. But I think it was interesting to see what a general audience member expects from a movie. And so, I had some ambition to kind of make people feel like this wasn't a first time feature. You just like it because you like it, or you don't like it because you don't like it, but not because it feels like it's not ready to be in the major league, so to speak, you know, that it was going to be on a craftsmanship level that can compete with any film. And so I think that was sort of the bar that we set for ourselves. And, you know, I set for myself, and then I set for the crew that we were going to go out and try to make something that felt, you know, more than a first-time feature film. And again, sticking true to the truth and, you know, again, using the resources that we had at our disposal, but trying our best to make it feel elegant and on the level of what a feature film should be.
You know, this is a film that we should clarify. It follows three different men in the aftermath of the shooting of an unarmed black man by police officers in New York. This was a kind of story that really woke society more broadly up to the regularity with which these kinds of killings took place. And it's kind of these videos which emerged and which are the real wake-up call have kind of slightly dropped off the news cycle a bit, really since the election of Donald Trump in 2016, certainly in the UK. And I wanted to ask about how, for you, the kind of the environment in the US has shifted since you kind of scripted the film and came to start thinking about it, compared to, you know, now, months after it's been released in the US, as it's being released in the UK.
It's an ongoing conversation, and that's always the way I've seen the film. And what I felt, my desire to tell the film, was that I felt people were becoming sort of numb to as many videos that were going on and not necessarily knowing, you know, how to talk about it. And even when you bring it up, it's like, oh, it's old news, or let's move beyond that. We've done enough to kind of address it. And I just, how is that possible? You know, every day you turn on the news and you see another shooting. So how is it possible that we've done enough? So that was sort of my instinct, that something needed to be done to at least re-engage with this subject matter, because we're becoming sort of immune. It's like, oh, which case is that again? Is that in South Carolina, or is that in Baton Rouge? And, you know, you kind of get lost and you forget which one, or, you know, forgetting the names of these folks that have basically sacrificed their life. And then, of course, I'm sure, you know, in the States, you've got the NFL and all the things that are happening there. So the conversation has just evolved from the time that I conceived the film to kind of where we are now. And, you know, I think, you know, listen, there's progress that's been made on both sides, in terms of the community, in terms of community engagement, in terms of celebrity engagement, in terms of folks saying, hey, this is an important issue that we need to talk about. But, you know, again, the job's not done. And I don't think it'll ever be done. It's one of those things where it's not like you can necessarily fix racism. It's never going to go away. But I think it's how do we live in a world together? How do we coincide? How do we make sure that unarmed black men and women are not being killed at such an alarming rate? And I think you know, that consciousness, being conscious, being able to talk about it, being able to have a dialogue about it, makes certain people accountable for their actions, whether it's police officers or people in the community. I think that was sort of the key for me, is how do we engage both sides as part of this conversation? So again, the film wasn't necessarily, you know, designed to end racism, as we sort of speak, but how do we re-engage with something that says, hey, it's important that we don't brush these issues under the rug. It's important that we continue to talk about them so that we are constantly engaging with best practices. What's the best way to move forward? What's the best way to engage on both sides of the issue? Because I think that's how we ultimately will reduce the number of killings in this country, is by being aware on both sides.
It's extremely striking the way that this film so empathetically presents, at its heart, has this police officer, an African-American police officer, who is kind of caught between, you know, identity and duty in some respects, and it acknowledges the complexities of these moments that police officers find themselves in. And in doing so, just manifests a kind of empathy and engages with a dialectic that you don't see often nowadays. Society in America seems so polarized that it's rare to have someone engage with both sides of the story like this.
Yeah, well, I think it's important because, again, even in the act of somebody doing something wrong, you know, again, even that could be blown out of proportion. So yes, and it happened to me. You know, I had a conversation with a police officer friend of mine. We grew up together in Staten Island, where Eric Garner got killed. You know, and that's where a lot of police officers, you know, police officers, firemen, so many people in Staten Island, that's their profession. And so I grew up with a lot of cops around me. And it was interesting because when I look at the Eric Garner case, you know, when I look at that video, the only thing I see is that a man that should be alive. And I had a real conversation with a cop about this tape. We were both looking at the same thing, and he saw something different. And I just couldn't understand. I couldn't understand how someone else could look at the same video, who sees this guy getting choked to the ground with a knee on his neck, that can see anything other than that this person should be alive. And he was, Ray, you don't understand. You're looking at 3 minutes. And you don't understand that they were trying to move him for 10 minutes. You don't understand that this police officer had a relationship with him. And this guy was, it's your job. You're being told by your bosses, you can't keep this guy on the street. You have to move him. What do you do? What do you do, Ray? And he just kept pushing. Ray, what do you do? And I, you know, of course, I'm getting combative at this time. And I'm saying, listen, I wouldn't have choked him. You know, I don't know. I would have yelled or warned or screamed. But, you know, he's like, again, Ray, you don't understand. That's not how it works. You know, like, that's not how the police work. You know, again, but his point was saying, listen, Ray, that cop was wrong. And he said to me, Ray, that police officer was wrong. But why do I, as a police officer, have to go and get training now that one guy did that? Now it's public news and now all police are bad. And so he felt like I was attacking him, although I was just trying to understand the psychology behind how this person could end up dead. And so it was interesting because I felt like I didn't necessarily agree with what he was saying. I didn't agree that, you know, that there was any other way to necessarily, I didn't agree with his point of view, but I also thought it was important to hear because he is right. You know, he wasn't there. He didn't grab him on the neck, and maybe he would have reacted differently in that situation. But because that one officer did it and it got recorded, you know, now he's sort of to blame, you know, and that's how a lot of people feel, like all police are, look, again, look at them. And again, if we put everybody into that one bucket, you know, I don't know if that's necessarily the right approach either. And so I think it was for me to identify, like, yeah, there are those people that are doing wrong, and those are the folks that we need to go after, and not everybody needs to be punished in that process. Again, there's cultural things and, I mean, institutional things that need to be addressed 100%, but there's also individual action. And it's hard, and that's where the gray area comes in, where you see a series of these cases. So yeah, maybe there's a really big problem going on, but, you know, again, not everybody's in that. There's 30,000 police officers in New York City, and how many of them need training? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to that. But again, you know, I don't think it's necessarily easy enough to just say all police need training because of this one situation that happened. I think we need to do a better job of drilling down and rooting out the real problem. And I think there's lots of men and women that are doing the right thing, and they should be applauded for that. They're putting their lives at risk for us, and, you know, and they should be applauded. And for the folks that aren't, that's what needs to be addressed. And it's hard. It's hard. How do you address a certain section of the population? And I think these are the questions that we're sort of asking in the film is, you know, what's the best way to approach that? I don't necessarily know the answer, but I know that something needs to happen where we're just not everybody's to blame for the actions of a few people.
I mean, another thing that strikes me about, you know, Monsters and Men is that for all that these very urgent questions are addressed kind of unflinchingly, it's also a very entertaining and very watchable piece of cinema. How did you kind of go about balancing the two requirements? You know, where was it important that you found the pivot in your mind between a film that people would want to watch and a people that would leave its audience, you know, reflecting on these subjects?
You know, it's important. It's entertainment. At the end of the day, it is entertainment, right? People go to the movies to be entertained, and they want something to enjoy. And so I wanted it to be my favorite movies, you know, whether it's an animation film or, you know, a musical, I think do that. They tackle real issues, really heartfelt human stories that connect with me on a deep human level, but also entertain me. And I wanted the film to do that. It's funny, I spent several months, I think I saw the film once at Sundance, and then I didn't look at it again for 10 months or something like that. When I saw it again, I was like, whoa, this is film's heavy. you know, I enjoyed it, but it was actually like shocking to me to see how heavy, you know, heavy the film was. And it was interesting during the process. It didn't dawn on me. You know, I thought I had more laughter or, you know, more moments of levity in the film that, you know, yeah, there's a few, but it was quite, like you said, it was unflinching. And I'm proud of that in some respects. I can't go back now. The film is what it is, and I'm proud of it, but it is important to find a balance, you know, in the filmmaking process, because again, it is a film, you know, it's a film. People want to be entertained. And if you do something that's too on the nose or too didactic, people feel like you're preaching. And I didn't want the film to do that. I didn't want it to feel like, hey, don't do this, or don't, you know, don't vote for these people. Like, you know, that, who am I to say that? It's up to you, the audience member, to engage with it in the way that you should. And I feel like we've tried to keep it objective that way. And I think the idea of perspective from the very beginning was definitely the approach that we took. Like, listen, hey, we're going to show you different perspectives. We're going to open your mind, and hopefully you feel like you're on the road with three different people and you can engage with this subject matter and say, hey, it's great, but also have a fun ride at the end of it.
That was Reynaldo Marcus Green, and Monsters and Men goes on general release in the UK from Friday.
You're with the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustine Macellari. We'll be speaking to musical enigma and former Bad Seed Mick Harvey in just a moment about his latest record. But here's one from the back catalogue. From 2007, it's Out of Time Man.
Nine when the clock says ten. This girl won't wait for the out of time man.
Out of Time Man there by Melbourne musician Mick Harvey, who's been making records since the 70s that have evolved from the primal punk of the Boys Next Door and the Birthday Party to the darkly gothic pomp of the Bad Seeds, all undertaken side by side with childhood friend and lifelong collaborator Nick Cave.
Harvey left the Bad Seeds around a decade ago, but was already making unusual solo albums and creative ventures on his own path before that. He worked with PJ Harvey, no relation, on her celebrated album Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea, back in 2000, and has continued to work with her on her more recent records. And he's been reinterpreting the works of French musical bon vivant Serge Gainsbourg in a series of albums since the mid-90s.
His latest album is The Fall and Rise of Edgar Bochier and the Horrors of War, a collaboration with British writer Christopher Richard Barker based on the events of the First World War. Monocle's Tom Hall sat down with Mick to learn more about the album.
I am the bastard son of war, and I bring you death and destruction.
It's a complicated backstory in some ways. I mean, essentially, it's a collection of World War I themed poetry that's been used as lyrics and turned into songs thematically. It's not a concept album with a story or anything. It's just simply a collection of works based on World War One poetry, effectively. That's the simple version. The backstory is that it's the poet himself is fictional and there's a character in Christopher's book and all this sort of stuff. There is a fictional backstory and there's a novel and all sorts of things that like this that Christopher is writing. Essentially, the album has to stand in its own right anyway at this point in time, so essentially that description probably is the best I can give you that's helpful to anyone who might be interested.
But it's all centred around the First World War.
All about a poetry based on the work of a fictional poet, fictional forgotten poet.
And what attracted you to that era then? I mean, is that something that you were focusing on yourself, you stumble on Christopher's work? How did you come to focus on that?
Yeah, I've had an abiding interest in things to do with World War One. I'm not quite sure when it began, but it's been spurred on through the years by, as with almost everyone, they discover they've got ancestors who were in it and or affected by it deeply. Or, you know, everybody's got ancestors back in that period, so it's almost inevitable, really. Then with PJ Harvey, we did Let England Shake, a lot of which was based on stories from that period and from other periods too, but there were quite a few things based on World War One stories, and which she brought me into that project knowing that I was very interested in that already. So she probably just wanted me there to play music. She did know that I was very interested in that period, and that kind of helped somehow have a communication about the material, and she probably felt that I'd be enthusiastic about it or would have a good angle on what she was doing.
Walker sees the mist rise over no man's land. He sees in front of him a smashed up waste ground.
There was a documentary about the history of Anzac that I did, which was narrated by Sam Neill back at like 3.5 years ago now, and I did like an hour's worth of music, which was largely World War One footage. And then Christopher, he was doing this whole project and had written these poems and so forth, and he read an interview with me somewhere, apparently this is what he's been saying, where I was talking about this interest in World War One. He simply got in touch with me to see if I'd be interested to work on this stuff, and it just developed from there.
I see it in the way we fight. I see someone dead, my friend.
A secret, hidden message.
Oh, everything is a secret, hidden message for me. It's a secret.
And, I mean, you're always collaborating, Christopher now, PJ Harvey, as you mentioned then. Do you always go into that with a really solid idea of what your contribution will be? Or is it, I mean, it's going to be different every time, but are you sort of, I'm the music guy, not the words guy, or is it, how does it work?
Well, people, you know, if I'm working collaboratively, they've almost always brought me in to work on the music and to help them realise the musical aspect of it. That's kind of my main job. If I'm writing lyrics at all, which I do rarely, it's kind of for my own projects or whatever, I find that a lot of people bring me in to play instruments of a particular type because they like the way I play a particular instrument, and different people, it'll be completely different instruments. This also means that they don't like the way I play something else and don't want me to. This is actually quite true. Like Roland S. Howard, for instance, really wanted me to play drums. He would not be interested in me playing bass at all or guitar. Actually, I did play a bit of rhythm stuff, but, you know, PJ Harvey likes me to play bass and keyboards. If I'm working with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, it was always pretty much playing guitar, and everybody wants me to play a different instrument, so I always get shuffled around onto things, and I'm fully aware they don't want me to play the other instruments. Can't explain that, but it is true.
Yeah.
the verdict on a record, it nearly always, I mean, obviously lies with just how it's received by the audience, and it turns into another thing once it's out there. But have you ever collaborated with people where you've really had to push for something that you think is right, and they've been like, oh, I'm not sure, but they sort of trusted your judgment, and then either in a positive or negative light, the release of the record sort of ratified whatever you were pushing for and showed that it was the right thing?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. It doesn't really normally work that way. I mean, usually if you're collaborating with someone and, you know, you're working on the thing together, there's a common vision or there's an understanding of what you're working towards. So I'm rarely in conflict with the people that I'm working with in that way, and you know, you're basically on the same page, and there's usually a guide. Like if it's Polly, for instance, she's more guiding the project, and you, part of your job is to understand what she's trying to do and work with that. So there have been a couple of occasions where I've been the producer effectively of a record and have pushed it more in the direction I wanted it to go. Yeah, but it's unusual. It's not usually happening with me. I'm usually much more in with the whole collaborative process. You know, a lot of producers do overlay their sound and their idea on whoever they're working with, and I don't tend to work like that.
Well, I wanted to talk about one aspect of your work, which in a way is sort of like an ongoing collaboration, because you seem to keep revisiting his work. It's the work of Serge Gainsbourg.
Okay. I didn't even know where you were going there for a minute.
You've made many records featuring his music, and you've approached it in different ways, translations and different setups and stuff. What is it about Serge's work which keeps you coming back?
Well, because there's so much of it, I guess, is the simple answer. I mean, I really did those first two albums back in the mid-90s and felt that that was finished, you know, that that was enough, because I've got a lot of my own work that I like to be, you know, immerse myself in and to be doing my own original work and so forth. I felt, right, I'm done with that project, and close to 20 years went by before I revisited, and that was really to do with the fact that the original two albums were reissued in a double album, and there was a regeneration of interest in the project generally, and so I was talking about it. I actually went and played some shows, which I'd never done, which was interesting, and that was great fun, actually, as it turned out, and somehow the mad idea to do more came up. And at first I was like, oh, I don't think so. You know, it was kind of people in the band saying, well, we should record some more songs. You know, there's all these songs, that hundreds of songs there. And eventually I kind of looked at the list of songs that I never did that I thought were going to be too difficult to translate, started thinking about them, and thought, well, actually, maybe it'd be really good fun.
Do you think
so? It wasn't like it was impossible to not to do it. It was really that just kind of presented itself in a strange way, and the next thing I knew I was doing it. I thought, well, after 20 years I can't do one. It's Serge Gainsbourg after all. I have to go too far and do another two albums, because there was just the requirement.
I've spoken to authors before who write not in English, and then they've had their works translated, and I've asked them, oh, do you feel that something gets lost in the translation? And what surprised me when I spoke to them is they said, oh no, I think it's more like, it's like a tighter edit. It's like another draft. Do you think that you get something different out of the different words that you're having to use?
A little bit, I think. But I think with novels, it's probably possible to do that thing where it's a tighter edit. I understand how that might be feasible with translation of prose, but with poetry, it's a tougher thing. And I think you do lose something inevitably. I think the standard, what's the quote, what you lose in the translation is the poetry. That's not quite true. What you lose in the translation is the feel of the original language and how those words relate to one another, because that's completely unique in any language, how you use words together, how they fit. Their meaning when they're placed next to one another has a particular feel and impact. You can't replicate that exactly. It's impossible to replicate that exactly. And when it's in a poetry form, that's really so specific. You know, in prose, it's more like you could get it, I think, and make it a bit tighter. But with poetry or lyrics, it's a bit harder to do that, because you're losing that interrelationship of the words. I suppose that's the poetry, in a way, the feel of the language. Unfortunately, that's changed. I can't help that.
Un jour, comme un autre, où je reste seul avec moi. Pourquoi Anna, Anna, restes-tu seule avec toi?
So what's the attraction? Because you're obviously a man who loves the written word and poetry. And so is it purely the challenge?
That was the interesting part of it, that there was so much material that people really didn't know. And I realised part of the barrier there was the language thing, that simply there was just a whole lot of songs in French. So it did switch that around and made it more accessible for people, pardon my diction today.
Serge Gainsbourg, he came from an era where to talk about sex in songs was risque. It's less so today, but we're also kind of...
It was probably always less so in France, actually, but anyway, yes.
Yeah, but with that more broadened horizons that we have today, we're also living in a much more sanitised version of the creative world, where maybe some of the things that he was getting at probably wouldn't be slightly so acceptable today.
You mean it's that they're a little un-PC?
Indeed, yeah.
I think they are probably
Do you think the
un-PC.
Music is becoming too sanitised in that way?
Well, there's things to... With any artistic... creative field, I think it's important to keep it as open as possible to express all sorts of ideas. And certainly the PC stuff tends to squash a bit of that freedom. So, you have to be respectful of changes in culture and so forth as well. I think it's generally heading in a really good direction with all of that stuff. It's interesting, though, if you really look at Serge's songs, they're not misogynistic or disrespectful to women, actually. And, you know, a lot of people have asked me, about that kind of aspect of him and his latter kind of Gainsbourg character, which was this, you know, kind of ridiculous drunken bore kind of, which was, I understand why he was doing that. But I think the evidence of how he was as a person is in the fact that all these really creative, powerful and intelligent women all just really loved him and respected him and didn't feel like he was exploiting them at all, apart from Franz Gall about their success, but that's another story. But incredibly, they loved him. And I think it's in the lyrics too. You can hear that if you listen to them, they're playful and they're having fun with the whole subject. They're not being disrespectful, I don't think, ever.
And I never wanted to shy away from an enormous cliche, but I would like to talk about sex, drugs and rock and roll, because you've been in some of the greatest rock and roll bands that there have been over the last sort of 30 years. You know, The Birthday Party, The Bad Seeds and more. Why do you think that sort of dark area of life is such rich fodder for forming great bands around?
I don't really know. I suppose it's partly the type of person who goes into creative fields or to do something that they're looking for artistic expression, and they're that kind of person who wants to do that as opposed to wanting to be commercially successful is the main driving factor or something. They're the sort of people who have a predisposition to needing that kind of thing, one, needing to kind of put themselves into different headspaces, and also they're kind of edgy people who don't fit in as well with, you know, it's that kind of person who has that predisposition. So you find a lot of people in music getting into drugs and stuff, or historically they used to, I suppose they still are. I don't really know what they're doing these days, the younger generation. I guess similar things are still going on. Now at my age, 60, I'm 60 now, the impacts of that, you can sort of see it, actually. There's been a high attrition rate, I can assure you, in the musical community I've been connected with. You know, it's way above the average in society, I think, just the number of people who aren't there anymore. Very damaging. But they're the kind of people who had that tendency, or they're in music because of a similar reason as why they're drawn to that kind of behaviour. It's kind of related, a mindset in a way, trying to be outside of society, the individual motivations, and trying to just find yourself in what this whole crazy world and universe is meant to be about, you know, just struggling with all of that and trying to make sense of it. And I think people like that end up in creative fields a lot. So
And finally, I'm interested in the object of the guitar, because it obviously for decades was this portal, this kind of vehicle for people to express themselves in these rebellious ways and stuff. But I think even people who, you know, I love guitar music, I think people are realizing that maybe today it's sort of losing its place in the hierarchy of music, of rebellion. Things like beat makers and programmers and stuff seem to be speaking louder. I mean, are there any bands today making guitar music or music of that sort of more traditional rock and roll ilk that are still exciting you?
I hear bands doing that still quite a lot, yeah, actually. It still has its excitement factor when it's executed with energy and with a bit of imagination, yeah. And there's a lot of bands in Australia are still very guitar-based, and I hear stuff coming out. It's like, you know, it's still quite great sometimes. I understand that it's lost its preeminence in kind of modern music. It still has a place, though, I think.
What's your recommendation for someone forming a band today? How do you stand out from the field today?
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of noise out there. That's a really tough one. I don't really know. I'm not really with Bob Dylan, who said, you know, oh, if I were starting out today, I wouldn't bother because it's too hard. I don't think that's true. I think he would have bothered. And two, I think you just, you know, if you want to make music, then you make music. It was never really about it being my career or making money out of it when I started out. I mean, that was a... The possibility that it might be was very attractive, but I didn't really think that it would work. So I've been very fortunate. But I think, I started out just wanting to make music. So, and I think that's, if you're in that position and you're wanting to do it, then you'll do it. So
do it.
just do it and see what happens. That's all I can really recommend. Don't stop because it's difficult.
No, it's not for me. Cold stare, it's not for me, it's not. They stare right through my weeping eyes, further down the line.
Mick Harvey there in conversation with Monocle's Tom Hall. And Mick's latest album, The Fall and Rise of Edgar Bossier and the Horrors of War, is out now on Mute Records. You're with the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Finally on today's programme, it's time for a look into the past. With the face of the city changed beyond recognition, recent years have seen a surge in nostalgia for the grim, dangerous, and yet boundlessly creative New York City of the 70s and 80s. Neglected as it may have been, the city was a hotbed of artistic endeavour where painters, filmmakers, and musicians took advantage of low rents, empty buildings, and a need for change to make work that continues to shape culture right up to the present day.
Jane Dixon is an artist who lived through those extraordinary days and documented them all in her paintings, drawings and photography. Tom and I caught up with her to hear more about her perspective on the city and how areas, especially Times Square, have changed over the years.
I'm not a city planner, but speaking as an individual, one of the things I was most excited about when I first arrived in New York was the sense that it was a maze full of unknown surprises. When I was taking these photos and living in Times Square, my block had already been condemned, and the city had a master plan to tear it down and clean it up. So I knew that this was the last days of this particular area. And while it was somewhat horrifying, it was also alluring and fascinating. And I feel like my point in recording things is not to tell you what to think, but to hopefully present them in all their complexity. You know, so it wasn't all bad back in the day, and it's not all bad now. Everything has its pluses and its minuses, and we're all always sort of figuring that equation.
Jane, the feeling that really comes through looking through the book is this kind of surreal quality that I think is partly the way you use light, and it definitely comes out of the pictures. I wanted to ask a bit about that, whether you felt that kind of surrealism of it at the time. How did you kind of reflect on the situation, you know, the danger of it as you were living it? Was it part of life, or did it feel like something that was maybe never going to last, or that had some extra dimensional quality to it?
I mean, New York was very dangerous then, and Times Square was dangerous. But it was a bit like living through a war zone. I mean, not as extreme. People weren't bombing us. But, you know, it's funny because it was somewhat dangerous, but I felt like the dangers were a little more clear. You know, then later we moved downtown when Times Square was renovated, and then we were right by the World Trade Center when that was bombed, which was, you know, and then there was this bombing of the bicycle path right by my house last year. So I feel like, in fact, this cleaned up version looks safer, but we're in fact in more danger since we left Times Square. I guess I felt partly that as a young woman, that the world has always been dangerous for children and women, and the suburbs growing up were dangerous from child molesters or whatever, just that people didn't talk about it. It was very hush-hush. So in a way, I liked that Times Square was, it was out in the open. It was explicit. You didn't let your guard down because you knew that most of the men walking on the street were there for sex and whatever else they could get away with. So, you know, I had to sort of look as tough as I could and walk with as much intention as I could, because if you stopped for a second, people thought you were, you know, looking for a date. I appreciated that there was the lack of pretense is what I'm trying to say.
In terms of what that meant for an artist like yourself, you were part, obviously, of Collab and other sort of looser and sort of not as sort of affiliated artist groups, but just like-minded individuals who were thrown together and, I guess, naturally focused on these areas that were full of all sorts of interesting dark energies. Was that incredibly important to have a dynamic, vibrant community who were all drawn together through different circumstances, I guess often because these places where they tended to gravitate around were cheap to live and work in? We're far away from that now, if you know, the areas are so sanitized. Do you think the art community, in the same way that the cities lose something, does the art community lose something if it can't allow young, like-minded individuals to get together to live and work together in cities? Are they kind of priced out of the equation?
Yes, but I would say that it's been a mobile world. The sort of art intelligentsia has been a mobile world for centuries. Artists and culture travels to wherever the climate is right at the moment. And so I think right now it seems like it's Berlin and Mexico City, and, you know, I'm sure there's other places that I don't know about. I think California is a easier place to survive as an artist than New York. Yes, New York is a victim of its own success. I guess I want to add in that I was born in Chicago, but then my father was from London. My grandparents lived in London. And when my parents separated, my mother moved to Paris when I was 14, and my father moved to Miami. So I was sort of triangulating all around, and it gave me more distance in my observations than if I had just stayed in the city I grew up in. I couldn't have really looked at Chicago in the way I looked at New York because I had grown up there, but I think that the darkness that I found in New York, I was reflecting my childhood, but then also this whole thing of gentrification. I had already seen it happen in Paris. My mother lived on the West Bank in the 6th arrondissement, and I watched in the 60s Paris sort of become a museum of itself. You know, it moved from being a sort of unselfconscious, you know, this is our local bakery, et cetera, to be like all the facades repainted and becoming very quaint and very touristy. And then when I came to New York, it hadn't had that transformation, but it started in the 80s. The same thing started to happen where people went, oh, this is a historical district, it's so cute. Well, we'll tear most of it down, but we'll keep a few things and we'll charge four times as much for a cup of tea and make it very special. So part of my view of New York was I could feel this shift coming and see that the New York I had entered was already a lost world heading into history. I joke that I didn't take do many pictures of my children because I've, even when I didn't do it consciously, if I, you know, when I was in California, I ended up painting a grocery store chain that was called Lucky Food. And then as soon as I painted it, it went out of business. So I said, I'm not going to paint my children because whatever I paint disappears and I don't want them to disappear. So even when it wasn't conscious, the things that I choose to focus on are things that are in flux.
While you're in Times Square, you worked on the first digital light billboard there, and you were there running the countdown for New Year's Eve, which has now become this sort of enormously commercialized, very touristy event. I'm sure you don't find too many real New Yorkers there. How offsetting that nascent tradition in the late 70s and early 80s against this kind of gigantic ticker tape spectacle that it is now. How do you kind of reflect on that? What was the experience like then?
Well, it already was a big deal. It was just a different kind of big deal. And it's actually interesting to think of that that spectacle does trace the same arc of professionalization and commercialization as everything in our world has in the past 30 years. Because people have been gathering in Times Square for New Year's Eve since it became Times Square for more than 100 years. In the 70s, when I was doing the countdown, the city was bankrupt. Times Square was relatively lawless. The police had been told not to bother doing much patrolling at all. It was considered, well, anyone who was still here was some kind of lowlife and who cares. And all the wealthy people had moved out to the suburbs. So in the 70s, on New Year's Eve, all of the stores would board up their facades with plywood because they were afraid of people rioting and breaking into their stores. While there were large crowds, when you got to the edge of the crowds, you would get mugged and robbed. There were thugs pickpocketing the drunks because it was large crowds of drunk people. And they were already, the police would cordon it off, so you couldn't enter Times Square after about 9 p.m. You had to already be there. So there were already huge crowds, but like the first year that I did this artist series on the Spectacolor billboard, where I invited my young friends like Jenny Holzer and Keith Haring and David Hammonds to do art projects, I proposed to my boss that we run them all right at midnight on New Year's Eve. And he said, sure, because nobody was paying for ads after 12, which seems so crazy now because you had, you know, not just the huge audience in Times Square, but you had a huge audience on TV. I don't know if they showed them, if they videotaped them for TV, probably not. But anyway, now, you know, it would cost you millions of dollars to buy that 1 minute after midnight slot. But just no one had thought to commercialize it yet. Now when you go to New Year's Eve, which I did, when I did a big mosaic project for the subway in Times Square Station, and the subject was New Year's Eve revelers, so I thought, oh, I haven't been to New Year's Eve in Times Square in a while, let me go. And it's so crowd-controlled now by police. They put you in these little pens. They divide up the whole of Times Square into this warren of little police barricades. So wherever you are, you're in a little pen with 100 other people, and you cannot move out of your section into another section. So people can't stampede and riot, but it also means you can't get out. If you go there, you have to be there for 4 hours and you can't pee. It's really terrible. But then all the shops are open for all these millions of tourists because it's well policed now, so the shops aren't afraid. So you're not very likely to get robbed anymore. It's safer, but it's extremely controlled. You feel like cattle.
That was Jane Dixon, and her book, Jane Dixon in Times Square, is out now. This is the Monocle Weekly. There you have it, Org. Another show where I feel we've learned so much. A great deal of wisdom from our guests, drawn from all different disciplines. But I don't know, there's a certain sort of value in having a good old sit-down. People like Jane, people like Mick that Tom Hall got to speak to.
And Ronaldo, of course. They're definitely a sage bunch with interesting things to say as well, both about the past and the present, and how the present can shape the future.
If you want to stay well on top as the future unfolds, join us on the Monocle Weekly every week, every Sunday. Org.
Indeed, it's going to be hard hitting this year.
Watch this space. Let's thank, though, the team that brought you edition 497 of the Monocle Weekly. It was produced by Org and by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. My thanks to them all. We'll be back, of course, at the same time next week.
Indeed we will. Until then, it's goodbye from me, Augusta Macellari.
And from me, Tom Edwards. Goodbye.
Goodbye.